Today's reading is from Romans. I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worth comparing with the glory about to be revealed to us. For the creation waits with eager longing for the revealing of the children of God. For the creation was subjected to futility, not of its own will, but by the will of the one who subjected it, in hope that the creation itself will be set free from its bondage to decay and will obtain the freedom of the glory of the children of God. We know that the whole creation has been groaning in labor pains until now, and not only the creation, but we ourselves, who have the first spirits of the Spirit, groan inwardly while we wait for adoption, the redemption of our bodies. For in hope we were saved. Now hope that is seen is not hope. For who hopes for what is seen? But if we hope for what we do not see, we wait for it with patience. The word of God for the people of God.
Both of our children are adopted, and we adopted them when they were babies. April and Brandon were in the same foster home together. April came out when she was 10 months, and Brandon came out when he was 4 years. I had it all written out. We were gonna save him, give him our name. He was going to grow up and go to college and—
Be a lawyer,
but he was going to just, it was just going to work out every way that I imagined it and planned it, but nothing works out as we plan it. We sent Brandon off to school on scholarship, not full scholarship, but he went away to the University of Illinois and got to about 3.5 years into his getting his degree. And then 2 years ago, actually this week at Thanksgiving was the last time we really heard from him. He sent us an email and said he wanted to break. He didn't think he believed in God anymore. He wanted to be away from us maybe forever. So there's just been this longing of waiting. Waiting for Brandon, but really waiting for God.
So the longing for us actually started that morning when we got the email. Brandon saying that he didn't really want to have anything else to do with the family, and he wasn't sure what his faith would look like anymore, and didn't believe there was a God, and not sure if he had a purpose. So for me, it's just been this longing over the last 2 years of wanting to reconnect and to know what really was going on with him, because it came so sudden. The last 2 months, God has just kind of broken down those walls, and there's just been this huge longing for God to intervene and to do God's thing. So that's what I'm looking for right now. Looking towards is God bringing this to completion.
As a child, he would get really sick and spend a week in bed. So knowing that he might be sick and I can't take care of him is very difficult as a mom to not be able to fix this. So as Brandon's mother, I have a longing for him to be complete again. I have a longing for him to be whole and to be well and to be back with us. I really want him to be reconnected with God, that's first, and then reconnected with us, because that's what's most important, for him to be well and to be whole. I don't, as a mother, want him to come back for a moment. I want him to come back to stay.
For those of you who may not know, Fran is our director of our contemporary worship service. His wife, Cheryl, works also at the church in our front office at the front desk. And this story, I appreciate their vulnerability and being willing to tell their story. It's a journey that we as a church staff have known about and been praying for the last 2 years, of their just uncertainty of not knowing where their son is, what he's doing, because he cut off all contact. And so we continue to pray with them on their journey to wholeness. What I think Fran and Cheryl articulated so powerfully was this desire for home. I mean, not just for Brandon to be home, but for their home to feel complete. There's something about the holidays in general that creates in our hearts an ache to be home. We have so many songs about it, right? You know, I mean, if you want to be happy in a million ways, how's the next line go? For the holidays, you can't beat home, sweet home. But home is more than just a physical place. It's more than just four walls and a couch and a TV or a kitchen. I mean, home is spiritually, emotionally, it's a place where our hearts are at rest, where we are gathered with those we love and connected with one another. That's what home is. So home can be both physical but even more spiritual. And what we're going to be talking about between now until Christmas is our journey, our collective journey towards home, but all the places that we stop on that journey. And we're going to look at places that are in the Christmas story: Rome, Jerusalem, Jordan, Nazareth, Bethlehem. But for each geographical place, it's more than just a place. Like the word home, they carry spiritual and emotional significance. They capture, we hope, our desire, our longing, and our waiting, our hope for peace and justice and simplicity and restoration in the world. It's all about our journey home. The furthest I've ever been home for the holidays, really the only time I could fully claim to have been away from home, came my first Christmas as a married man. Jamelyn and I, right after we got married, we moved down to Haiti to live there for 2 years. We moved down in August, and that first Christmas that came around, that was our first time to be away from home and to really feel the homesickness that holidays kind of, you know, that ache in our hearts. It started in Thanksgiving, on the day of Thanksgiving, because in Haiti, Thanksgiving is not a holiday at all. They don't have the story of the pilgrims and the Native Americans, so it's you know, they don't even have it. They were aware that it was a holiday where we were from, but for them, it's a work day. We went down to school, worked all day. I remember walking back up from from the school up, and it's 80-something degrees. I know we had a warm Thanksgiving, but it was really hot in Haiti, and I'm sweating, and I just, as I'm walking up the mountain, I'm just like, you know, this doesn't feel like Thanksgiving. And I was tired and worn out, and we walked back into the center of the compound where we were staying, and we smelled, Jamel and I smelled in the kitchen, they were baking a cake. And you have to understand, they don't bake cakes in Haiti all the time, or at least where we lived in Haiti. It was only every, you know, few months that there would be that kind of celebration. And so our hearts were touched. We felt like, oh, they remembered that this is an important day for us. They're baking a cake for us, and we're going to have a big celebration that night. And so we spent the next few hours, you know, in our room smelling the cake and anticipating the feast that we were going to have for dinner. When we got to dinner, there was one 9x13 pan of reheated rice and beans. That's it. And I know it's Thanksgiving, and we should have been thankful that we were receiving food and sustenance, that we were cared for, even in a foreign land. But honestly, it was the worst Thanksgiving ever. I mean, it was awful. And that was kind of like the start of the whole holiday season. It wasn't just that we were in a foreign land, although that was part of it. We were still learning the language, still, you know, kind of aware of that. You know, that we were white-skinned, everyone called a blanc, in a place where it's predominantly dark-skinned. That was part of it. It was the fact that there wasn't holiday music. You know, think about how much we have holiday music in all, you know, in our cars and our shopping malls. There were no shopping malls. There was no shopping and wrapping presents. All that stuff was kind of stripped away, and it didn't feel like Christmas to us until, you know, maybe Christmas Eve. Jamelyn was sitting out on the porch, on the bench outside our room, and she described it, you know, in Haiti on market days, which happened twice a week, everyone goes up in Fondoy, everyone goes up to the top of the hill to kind of sell and exchange the goods, you know, their crops or whatever they have, and the whole kind of village kind of moves up to the top of the mountain, so you see this endless parade of people on the road in front of where we lived. And Jamelyn said she was having a cup of coffee, sitting outside. Both of us were probably having a little pity party for ourselves when she saw a donkey going by and a woman who was pregnant riding on the donkey going up to the market. And she said, oh, you don't see that in the U.S. This is, maybe this is more like Christmas should be. And so we tried to change our hearts. We went home. We went to church that evening with our neighbors, and they weren't the familiar carols we knew, but we joined in singing and worshiping with them, and we went home that night to our bedroom, and we opened up Luke 2, and we read the Christmas story. And when you read that first line, a decree went out from Caesar Augustus that all the world should be registered. I swear I'd never heard those words in the same way as I heard them that night living in a foreign land. And it wasn't just the experience of being far from home. It was also the experience of being in a place where there was a lot of insecurity. You see, this was 2004, and literally 3 or 4 weeks later, President Aristide was going to suffer his second coup d'etat, be ousted from the country. His first one came in the 90s, and he was out of the country for 4 years. He was the first democratically elected president of Haiti, and within 6 weeks of him taking his presidency, he was kicked out. And then 4 years later, with the help of our government, he came back into power, was reelected in the year 2000, but his second term didn't go any better than first. In fact, it went far worse. And so by the time 2004 had hit, there was a lot of unrest in the country. There were daily protests taking place in the streets of Port-au-Prince. The protests were put down by the government. The rumors were that there was, you know, gas and guns and police brutality at play. People were hungry and desperate. And even though in Fondwa, where we lived up in the mountains, it was a silent night, there was this political tension that was in the air. And we thought to ourselves, maybe this is what Israel felt like 2,000 years ago. Jesus was born underneath the reign of Caesar Augustus, at the height of Roman power and influence. Just 25 years earlier, Caesar Augustus had been crowned, made himself really the emperor, the Caesar of the entire Roman Empire. And he instituted the Pax Romana, the Roman peace. As Matt said in our video before, it was a time of security and prosperity, but it was also a time of enforced peace. So that when he made a rule that all the world should be registered, no one got to opt out of that. It didn't matter that your wife was 9 months pregnant. It didn't matter that your hometown, Bethlehem, was a long way from where you live. Caesar ordered and you obeyed. That's the way the story went. You know, sometimes we read these words, a decree went out from Caesar Augustus that all the world should be registered, and we think of Peanuts and Linus reading it, and it sounds so idyllic and peaceful. It's like the well-known words to, you know, like we all know this story too. Like if we say, a long, long time ago in a galaxy far, far away, you know the rest of the story. And there's weird, odd parallels between the empire and Rome, but I don't have a whole sermon for that. But the point is these weren't just familiar words. They describe the setting. They tell us, they set in motion the events of the story. They tell us where Jesus was born, that he was born underneath the authority of Rome. And what did it mean to be underneath Roman authority? Well, to be underneath Roman authority, yes, you were the beneficiaries of their laws, their literature. They brought with them a knowledge of building roads and aqueducts and infrastructure. I mean, there were a lot of benefits and perks, but with those perks came subjugation. There were taxes, oppressive, burdensome taxes to pay for all that building and infrastructure. This literature and laws, the Roman culture, it wasn't just a gift. For many Jews, they experienced it as an attack. It undermined their traditional values of Sabbath keeping and keeping kosher. There were foreign gods installed into the great temple in Jerusalem to Yahweh. And the leaders over them were not, you know, the promised leaders in the line of David. They were weak, insecure men like Herod, who at the mere suggestion that there was a king born that was prophesied would be so threatened by that that he would order the slaughter of every child under the age of 2. the Gospel Matthew, he quotes Jeremiah to capture the feeling of Israel at this time. He says, "The voice of Rachel, a voice was heard in Ramah, wailing in loud lamentation. It is Rachel weeping for her children. She refused to be consoled because they are no more." Do you know where Ramah was? I didn't. This is a picture of modern-day Ramah. Back at the time of Jeremiah, when those words were first spoken, a voice is heard in Ramah. Ramah was the deportation site. When the Babylonians came and destroyed Jerusalem and the temple, they took the people into slavery, and they were brought to Ramah, and there they were put in chains and marched across the desert. That's why the voice is heard in Ramah, weeping and wailing for her children. That's where Israel was. They were captives, even in their homeland. Now, that's a far cry from where you and I stand today, right? I mean, we are not captives in our own land. We have freedom, autonomy. We can voice our opposition and not be punished for it. We can vote. We can gather in our homes and feast and celebrate. We can go shopping and put up Christmas decorations. I mean, we're in a good place. And yet, if we just listen, we have to kind of recognize that the Christmas story takes place underneath this captivity in a place of exile. And if we just listen, perhaps we can hear the voice of Ramah, the voice of Rachel weeping for her children. I mean, just think about the events of the past year. You got the rise of racism and the white nationalist movement that's gaining strength and voice all the time. You have constant, and I mean constant, news of sexual abuse taking place in our workplace. Women suffering underneath the men who we count on to inform and lead and entertain us. You have bombs and shootings that are too numerous to count. I mean, I could just recount some of the places of London and Paris and Texas and Las Vegas, and even this weekend, there was the bombing of a mosque in Egypt, over 300 killed. And it's not just the bombings and the shootings themselves. It's a year ago, we didn't think about rental vans as something to be afraid of. A year ago, none of us knew the term bump stocks, and now we do. Throw in that humanitarian crises that are taking place in Syria and Myanmar, whole people groups being exterminated or removed. International tensions, North Korea, Iran, Zimbabwe now. And then you bring it back home, and there's uncertainty about healthcare and taxes and the environmental reform. And whatever side of the political aisle you may be on those issues, you at least have to admit that there's just fear about, we don't know how these decisions that are being made in Washington are going to impact our world and our economy and our daily lives. And then you throw in natural disasters that we can't do anything about, but Hurricane Irma and Hurricane Harvey, and earthquakes and flooding and landslides. Do you feel it? Creation groaning for liberation. And I know I kind of feel like Gru and Despicable Me popping the child's balloons, that, you know, like we're just coming off Thanksgiving here, and here I'm just popping the balloons, like you can't stay happy and feel good, but that's, that to some degree, that's the point. My wife has an Apple Watch or whatever, and so she gets these updates on her watch. Every time there's a bad headline, it pops, or if you have your phone, it bings, and you pull it out, and you're like, again, even in the midst of our holidays, there's these punctures. The cries of the world keep breaking in. And so the good news I offer today is not to run and hide from what's happening in the world, but simply to acknowledge that God feels the groaning of creation too. What God said to Moses at the very beginning of the Bible is, God says, "I hear the cries of my people. I have seen their distress, and I am concerned about them. My heart is moved to act. And so when perhaps when God sees the groaning of creation today, he sees, he hears, he is still moved to act. He is concerned about us. He is sending a liberator. And that's what the story of Christmas is about. I want to capture it, if I can, in this Romans passage about the groaning of creation, because Paul uses this very clever shift in metaphors that I think captures the source of our good news. And so stick with me. I just want you to see one thing about this passage. He begins with this creation waits with eager longing for the revealing of the children of God. For creation was subjected to futility, not of its own will, but by the will of the one who subjected it, in hopes that the creation itself will be set free from bondage to decay and will obtain freedom. Now, so the first metaphor is this. It's an Exodus metaphor, that just like the Israelites were underneath the power of Egypt, just as they were groaning and crying out underneath slavery, under the lash of the oppressor, Paul is saying, so is all creation. It's subjected to futility, not of its own will, but by the will of someone else. It's in bondage. It's waiting for freedom. That's the first metaphor. But then Paul shifts it in the next verse. He says, for we too, we know that the whole creation has been groaning in labor pains until now. But not only the creation, but we ourselves, who've received the first fruits of the Spirit, we groan inwardly while we wait for adoption, the redemption of our bodies. Now, did you catch it? It's very slight. I had to read this a lot of times before I caught it. In the first verse, the groaning is the groaning of slavery, groaning for redemption, hoping to be set free. But here, what's the groaning? It's the groaning of labor pains. It's the groaning of God birthing something new. It's a redemptive pain that has a happy ending. In fact, Paul suggests that the ending is going to be so happy and so glorious that we won't even be able to compare to the sufferings of today. He's implying just like a mother after the child is born is so happy about that she forgets about the labor pains, which I recognize as a guy you're not supposed to say, but I'm just quoting Paul. I don't know what the labor pains are, but that's what Paul says, and maybe it's true. But the point is that what God, the second metaphor is so powerful and redemptive because it tells us that God is bringing something new into the world. And perhaps that's why birth narratives are so important in both the story of Exodus and the story of Christmas. Both of them begin with the birth of a child. In both cases, the birth takes place underneath foreign oppression. In both cases, there's simplicity involved. The mother of Moses places him in a basket of reeds, and Jesus places in a manger. In both cases, there's protection. The mother releases the child to hide him from soldiers that are killing Hebrew males. For Mary, she flees of all places to Egypt to protect her child. But it all begins with the birth. In fact, the whole story of the Exodus is in some ways a metaphor for birth. Why do the Israelites spend 40 years in the desert? Well, 40 is the number of weeks it takes a woman to carry a life from conception to full birth. God is birthing something new. And in that birthing process, there is pain, but there is also hope. To me, this transforms how I think about Christmas. It's the story from bondage to birth. We begin, certainly, with the bondage and the groaning of creation, but the end of the story is God bringing something new into the world. And because of that, then we can take a redemptive understanding towards the pain we experience. All those things I put on the screen earlier, I don't know how God's going to use the pain. I don't know how God's going to redeem the suffering. But if this Christmas story is true, if what Paul is saying is real, then they're not pointless suffering. They're not just creation crying out in slavery. It's also the pain of God bringing something new in the world. I don't know how God's going to use all the women who are coming forward and saying, me too. Except maybe God's going to use it to bring a new understanding and a new compassion and a new way of being in our workplace. How is God going to use the anger of the white nationalist movement? I don't know. But perhaps God's going to create a place where more people can enjoy the fruits of our society, where more people can find dignity and hope. How is God going to use bombings and terrorist shootings? I don't know. But perhaps he's going to teach us to be more respectful and honoring of different faiths and different religions. Maybe that's what it takes for us to bring an end to the violence we see. God is going to do something new. And you may be experiencing pain in your personal life, the kind that Fran and Cheryl talked about in the beginning. You may be broken in your home, in your marriage, in your family. And you may be thinking, what is God ever going to do with this pain? I don't know, but I believe God will use it redemptively to birth something new in you and through you into the world. Because that's what our God does. He's in the business of new birth. That Christmas when we were in Haiti, our first Christmas, that Christmas Eve, a new child was brought into the orphanage. His name was Jed. That's the name the sisters gave him. He was 7 months old, but he looked almost like a preemie. He was so malnourished, but the sisters brought him back to health. They explained to us the name Jed. It was like an acronym. They said it was for Joseph Emmanuel Dave, which instantly made Jamelyn mad, because why couldn't the J be for Jamelyn? How come I always get the name, she said. But for me, the initial that matters is that middle one, E, Emmanuel. God is with us. Fast forward a number of years to 2010 when the earthquake took place. I had the opportunity to go with St. Luke's, members of St. Luke's, for four or five of us to go down right after the earthquake, as soon as they reopened the airports, taking down tarps and tents and hygiene kits, everything that this church had put together to send down. And we distributed them to all the people there, and we slept underneath the tents that we brought. And I remember one particular night, there was this massive storm. And this was the power of the earthquake in 2010, that this was 5 weeks later, and yet still sleeping in the mountains. That night, we could feel the aftershocks, the tremors of the earthquake were still happening. And this night, it was a terrible night. I mean, the wind and the rain was just lashing us, and these tents were made in such a way that they would collapse when the wind hit and then pop back up. That was their way of staying, you know, intact, I guess, which makes sense, except it was miserable to sleep underneath, because about every 30, 45 seconds, the whole canvas would like pop down on you and then pop back up. And I remember at one point the wind was so fierce that it ripped the roof, the tin roof, off of the enclosure that the orphanage children were under. You heard the screen go up, and then you looked out the tent and you saw that the tent had been blown away, and rain was now coming in where the children were. And in the midst of all this chaos, in the midst of all this screaming, a woman arrived who was in labor pains, about to give birth. And it was something was going wrong with the pregnancy. It wasn't going like a normal pregnancy should. And so they very quickly threw her in the back of a pickup truck and took her up the mountain and down to the nearest hospital. Anyways, the next day, I remember what it was like that morning. You know, it was like the morning after a terrible storm, or the morning after you haven't been able to sleep at all. And we were all groggy and tired, and we were picking up, you know, sticks and branches and tin that had blown away. And we were all kind of worn out. And in the midst of that morning, we saw the truck come back. And when the truck pulled up close to us, there was that mom in the back of the truck holding her newborn baby. And later that day, we had church because it happened to be a Sunday. And the priest, Father Joseph, who was presiding over the service, he said, that child coming into our midst, it is a sign of hope. A sign that God is not done in our world yet, because if God's bringing new life into us, then there must be a future beyond the devastation that we see right now. Hope. Paul says we hope not in what we see, but in what is unseen. Hope in what we see isn't really hope at all. I don't know what God wants to birth in us this Christmas. Perhaps a starting place is simply to open the door and to allow his hope to enter. To believe that God can do more in our midst and in our hearts than we could ever imagine. That's where Christmas begins.